Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 1:33 p.m. We're in Belts Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, April 8th, and I would like to wish a very happy birthday to my esteemed colleague from Anchorage to my right, Senator Alvy Gray Jackson, as well as a most excellent staffer in Senator Merrick's office, Sorsha Hazelton. So happy birthday to both of you fine ladies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members present today are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Bishop will be coming along shortly. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I'd like to recognize and welcome our reporting secretary, Lisa Denny, and our LAO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht, here today. We have three items on our agenda. First up is Senate Bill 102, Refuse Utility Regulations, followed by Senate Bill 219, Prior Authorization Exemption for Health Providers, and lastly, House Bill 97, Self-Storage Units, Liens, Sales. First up is Senate Bill 102, Refuse Utility Regulations. This is our second hearing on this bill. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee first heard the bill on March 4th when we had a presentation as well as invited in public testimony. Today we have the bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Rob Myers, and his staff, Dawson Mann, here to present and provide a brief recap of the bill. Gentlemen, please join us at the table. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Myers, Senator for District Q up in the North Pole and eastern part of the Fairbanks North Star Borough area. Just as a quick recap, SB 102 is a pretty short bill. What it is doing is it is taking the simplified rate filing that already exists in the RCA and applying it to refuse utilities rather than just the electric co-ops that they've been using it for some time now as a way to speed up some of the regulatory processes.
Very good. Mr. Mann, did you have anything you'd like to add?
For the record, Dawson Mann, staff to Senator Myers. Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman, members of the committee. Happy birthday, Senator Gray Jackson. I have nothing to add at this time.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? I have one question. Senator, we've heard from some folks out of Anchorage that this may somehow impact the municipality of Anchorage, and there may be others who have similar concerns. Can you speak to the impact of this bill, Senate Bill 102, on the municipality of Anchorage and others similarly situated?
Mr. Chair, we heard from the municipality of Anchorage as well regarding SWS, and it is our understanding, and Mr. Mann can expand on this. It is our understanding, having looked at some previous documentation, that the RCA does not regulate solid waste services in Anchorage, and this bill will not change that status.
Most excellent. Mr. Mann.
For the record, Dawson Mann. For further clarification, in review of RCA filings in the past, the RCA has exempted the municipality of Anchorage from certain sections of statute for their trash collection services, and this bill would not in any way change the existing relationship between the RCA and the municipality of Anchorage.
Very good. Any comments, questions? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I'm really happy to hear that because I thought from day one that SWS was not regulated by RCA, but thank you for confirming that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we had discussed that during the first hearing as well. SWS has sort of a unique situation. It seems like there's a simple solution. You could put regulated refuse utilities. I did not prepare an amendment today, so I'm not going to make a conceptual amendment. But I'm curious, is there a House companion for this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, there is not. This is the only version of this bill out there right now.
I guess I would suggest that when you go over to the House side, if this, assuming this passes, you might consider an amendment just to put regulated in front of refuse utilities to make it clear this only applies to the currently regulated refuse utilities. But just something to consider if SWS maintains those concerns as this bill moves forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other committee questions or comments, this time I will reopen public testimony on Senate Bill 102. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 102? Seeing none, we have one person online wishing to testify. Kurt Froning, please state your name and location and begin your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Kurt Froning. I'm the Division Vice President for Alaska Waste. My office is here in Anchorage, Alaska. Just for a comment, I would just like to say, first of all, thank you for all your hard work you're doing down there in Juneau. And I'd like to just once again express our ongoing support for this bill. If it was passed, it would substantially decrease the amount of time and expense required to adjust to rates. I think it would enable refuse utilities to react to current market conditions and respond to smaller, more frequent adjustments rather than large increases that come years and years apart. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? This time I'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 102. Any further committee discussion? Seeing and hearing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 102, version 33-L-SUGAR-0583-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, Senate Bill 102 moves from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for our next bill.
Back on the record at 142, we'll take our next bill on the agenda is Senate Bill 219, Prior Authorization Exemption for Health Providers. We first heard this bill on March 13th when we had a presentation of the bill and took invited testimony. Today is my intention to hear a recap of the bill, review the sectional analysis, and take additional invited and public testimony, and then set an amendment deadline. We have bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator David Wilson, and his staff, Julia Fanaz, here to present a recap of the bill and review sectional analysis. Senator, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman and committee members, and again, happy birthday, Senator Gray Jackson. For the record, this is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District N, and with me is my trusty staff.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Julia Fanaz, staff to Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 219 aims to reduce the wait time for certain healthcare providers by exempting the most qualified healthcare providers from making pre-authorization requests for said services. Currently, Alaskans who need certain healthcare providers must wait days or even weeks to get pre-authorization services, and we have Alaskans who are also on the phone worried and trying to help to get their pre-authorizations for complex medical needs, because we don't really have a managed care system to help coordinate those services. So that's up to the individual providers or the individual Alaskans themselves to conduct this process. This bill would help Alaskans receive healthcare services immediately, especially in healthcare services that could help save their lives. Healthcare providers who qualify for pre-authorization exemptions, if they have 80% of their prior authorization requests submitted in the last 12-month period, who were approved for those healthcare services. Those utilization review entities will provide healthcare providers a list of healthcare services which the exemption applies for the duration of the exemption. This would help eliminate unnecessary delays in the care by granting providers exemption who have demonstrated a consistent adherence to the approval guidelines from those prior authorizations requirements. This sometimes is referred to as the gold card in other states. In other states, we're not the first state to come up with this, and I believe Ms. Fonoff may have the number of states that have already passed this legislation or are currently considering this piece of legislation, and it has shown to help provide a little bit more efficiency in healthcare services. Maybe not. Nine? Ah, yes. It was my binder that I forgot. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
It's okay.
And that ends a quick summary of 219.
Thank you very much, Senator. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or staff before we begin the section? I have a question.
Yes, sir.
And maybe as we have invited testifiers, they could speak to this as well. When we consider whether prior authorizations are accepted or not, is 80% the right number, and is that the right measure of things? I'm wondering, are insurance companies incentivized to just deny doctors prior authorization requests so that providers wouldn't qualify? Is that number possibly too low? Should there be a higher standard? Or I'm also wondering what a better measure might be on the back end if claims and care given was paid out because that care was in line with the industry standard and the medical necessity for a patient after an audit of a certain amount of time. Those are some questions that I've been pondering.
Yes. To the chair, Senator Wilson, for the record, we do have a couple of folks that are online that have utilized this in other states that have seen this nationally, and they could probably speak a little bit more detail upon the 80th percent. And our intent is this would be 80% after the claims or denials management, so we don't just have folks just deny just so they can deny to the 79% so they don't have to do this. And so we just want to clarify that for the record. And so we're just starting off the number there, as this was model legislation that we taken and sort of looked at from other states as well. And so I think I'll leave that, and maybe Dr. Silva can talk a little bit more upon the back end measurements as a part of our invited testimony.
Very good. Thank you. All right. Ms. Fanoff, would you please walk us through the section?
Yes, for the record, Julia Fonoff, staff to Senator Wilson, through the chair, I will be going through the sectional analysis for Senate Bill 219, version A. Section 1 amends the insurance statutes by adding a process for the Director of Insurance to adopt regulations for utilization review entities who are individuals that perform prior authorization as established under Section 2 of this bill. So Section 2, it adds a new section, utilization review entities to our insurance statutes. And it adds Section A, which explains a healthcare provider is not required to complete prior authorization for a covered person if at least 80% of prior authorization requests submitted by the provider for that healthcare service has been approved in the past 12 months. Section B explains a healthcare provider may be evaluated if they continue to qualify for an exemption not more than once every 12 months, and an existing exemption is not required to be evaluated and a longer exemption period may be established. Section C explains healthcare providers do not have to request an exemption to qualify for an exemption. Section D explains if a healthcare provider is denied an exemption, they may request evidence once every 12 months on why they were denied, and an explanation of how to appeal the denial, and the healthcare provider may appeal the denial. Section E explains utilization review entities may revoke an exemption after 12 months if they determine the healthcare provider doesn't meet the 80% approval criteria, and they provide the healthcare provider with the information used to determine revoking the exemption, and they explain to the provider how to appeal the determination. Section F explains the exemption remains in effect until 30 days after the provider is notified of the decision to revoke the exemption, or if the healthcare provider appeals the determination 5 days after the revocation is kept after appeal. Section G specifies a decision to revoke or deny an exemption by utilization review entity must be made by a healthcare provider licensed in Alaska with the same or similar specialty as the healthcare provider being considered and must have experience providing the healthcare service for which the requested exemption applies. Section H specifies a utilization review entity must provide a healthcare provider who receives an exemption of this section with a notice that includes a statement that the healthcare provider qualifies for an exemption for prior auth and the duration of the exemption, and a list of the healthcare services for which the exemption applies. Section I specifies utilization review entities may not deny a reduced payment for a healthcare service exempted from prior authorization, including a healthcare service ordered by an exempted provider that is performed or supervised by another healthcare provider, unless the healthcare provider providing the healthcare service knowingly misrepresented the healthcare service in a request for payment with specific intent to deceive and obtain an unlawful payment from a utilization review entity, or if they failed to substantially perform the healthcare service. And Section J will be just the definitions section, and Section 3 provides an immediate effective date. And that is the end of the sectional analysis.
Thank you, ma'am. Are there any questions on the sectional? Seeing and hearing none, as a reminder to committee members, we have the following individuals available for questions: Heather Carpenter, Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance; Pam Venkin, Director of the Alaska State Medical Association; Jared Kozin, the President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. If folks have questions, that crew of very competent people stand ready to answer any or all questions that you might have. We have a few invited testifiers today. First up, we have Dr. Ezekiel Zeke Silva. Mr. Silva, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and location and begin your presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Zeke, Z-E-K-E, Silva. I'm actually calling from Washington, D.C., but I practice in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm speaking for the Texas Medical Association, which is a collaborator with the Alaska State Medical Association through the American Medical Association. The reason I've been invited to testify, and again, Mr. Chair, thank you for this opportunity, is that the state of Texas was the first state to pass a law to address prior authorization at the state level with our state-regulated plans. Therefore, I offer myself to this committee as a resource based on our experience. That legislation passed in 2021. That legislation was in response to not just a perception, but a reality that our physicians were expressing to us, that the prior authorization process was causing them not only undue burden, such as two full-time equivalents doing nothing but prior authorization on a weekly basis, but also the denial to very commonly perform services, including services that were very much front and center to what our physicians were experiencing. But I think the greatest motivation for us in Texas was our physicians were telling us that the majority of them were experiencing significant patient harm from prior authorization, patients abandoning treatment, patients not receiving treatment in timely fashion, and even more significant consequences, such as loss of bodily function and even death. Therefore, for us, the impetus was great, and to this day, we're proud of our action at the state level. The legislation in 2021 did pass and went into effect later in the year. We attempted in 2023 during our legislative session to, for lack of a better term, sort of tune up the regulations around the law, but that we were not able to get that passed. So we do perceive that some improvement could be made, but we just would like, again, speaking to the chair, just would like to acknowledge Alaska's efforts here. And if there's any questions, Mr. Chair, I may answer for committee members or others. I'm honored to be a resource for this group. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Dr. Zeke, I have a question. Based on your experience in Texas, are you able to identify pieces of this bill that we have before us that could be improved based on your experience, or are there things that we have gotten right in this bill based on your experience in Texas that we should be proud of?
Mr. Senator, thank you for the question, and speaking to the chair, the answer is yes on all fronts. I think this bill is well constructed, and I think the question was answered earlier by a member, and again through the chair. Now, I think the 80% number is reasonable. I think it's worth pointing out that would essentially, at least in Texas, and as I read this legislation, would apply to the same service. So imagine an orthopedic surgeon being approved for knee replacements. You know, if he or she achieves 80% approval on that particular procedure, then that would result in the gold card and an exemption from prior authorization going forward. The other question I think was a comment that was an excellent one was regarding medical necessity. I think it's worth stating that physicians, even though we're subjected to considerable retrospective or review during the decision process, after we've worked with our patient to inform our medical recommendation and plan of care, that the medical necessity piece is important to us. Anything we bill, Medicare or otherwise, has to document the medical necessity of the procedure anticipated, the reason for the exam, and importantly, the diagnoses supporting that examination. I will tell you, senators, that in speaking to the chair, you know, our adoption in Texas has been relatively low. In fact, it's been as low as 3%. When I say that number, I mean only 3% of our physicians have achieved gold card status. And I think part of that is because the requirements are so specific. And what I mean by that is that 80% number is not only per physician, but it's per exact procedure, which many of you may know are described by what are called current procedural terminology or CPT codes. And then it has to be per payer, and even sometimes through individual payer product. So imagine IPO, EPOs, and HMO products and the like. The consequence of that is it's oftentimes hard for our physicians to achieve 80% across that many different metrics. So my recommendation, I believe this is in the bill, would be to not include a minimum. In Texas, our minimum is 5, which has been somewhat hard for our physicians to achieve. I would recommend not advancing a minimum just to ensure that the benefits of this and protecting patients from the harms of prior authorization can have maximal effect. Thank you.
No, thank you for those comments, Dr. Zeke. I have a follow-up question to that.
Sure.
Based on your expertise and experience,
might it make more sense that a physician or provider be able to achieve the gold card status if they have the 80% approval based on a group or classification of codes rather than just one individual code?
I'm not sure the question. It may be a problem on my end.
Oh, I apologize. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, thank you, Senator.
Very good. My question is, might it be better that a physician be able to achieve gold card status if they reach an 80% approval metric based on a group of codes or kind of a class of codes that might be done together when they're looking to get prior authorization?
Yeah. Thank you for the question, Senator, and through the chair. I think that's an excellent and insightful question. Some of our discussions in Texas centered on not just individual, I used a procedural code, but imagine a hospital admission where there's multiple evaluation and management codes, or imagine a pharmacological pathway of care for, say, an oncology patient where multiple different medications are being prescribed based on different metrics of the patient's disease progression, even their age and weight and other factors. So I think it's completely logical to have larger groups of codes included and the 80% number being applied to that group collectively. I think that would maintain the spirit of the legislation, which is to make sure that physicians practicing the best care possible are not further subjected to prior authorization, but also acknowledging that patients are different, that medicine, even though it is a science, it is oftentimes an art where decision-making between the physician and patient can differ based on the patient's varied circumstances in the practice of medicine and the evolution of the practice of medicine. Thank you, Senator.
Any further questions for Dr. Zeke? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today, sir. Up next, we will hear from Jeff Davis. Mr. Davis is joining us via the Teams Hub. Please state your name and location for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Bjorkman. My name is Jeffrey Davis. I'm Senior Vice President for Radiation Business Solutions, longtime Alaska resident currently residing in East Wenatchee, Washington, and calling in from there today. Joining you as an interested person in this legislation. Just a little bit about my background. I spent 18 years as the president of Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, and part of a long career in healthcare, and have spent the last 5 years on the provider side, which I hope brings a perspective that is balanced to this discussion. To me and to others that I've spoken with, and I think in the, from as you've heard from Dr. Silva, Senate Bill 219 is primarily about patient protection. That's, patients are often overlooked in this debate, but it is true in my experience that the patients bear the majority of the cost of unnecessary prior authorization in the form of physical, emotional, and financial harm resulting from delays in care. And it's very real. You can find study after study that shows, you know, significant numbers of patients not following through on treatment or having adverse impacts because of the impact of prior authorization. So it's not a trivial thing. And it's not all about the provider and it's not all about the payer. It's about the patient. From my perspective, again, being in the industry for a long time, the original goals of prior authorization were good. And it was designed to reduce unnecessary care and to make sure that things that were paid for were needed, but at this point in time, it has grown unchecked and has become a problem rather than a solution. But it's really important, I think, for all to, as we've heard from Senator Wilson and from Ms. Vonhoff, that this bill doesn't eliminate prior authorization, but it seeks to restore a balance to a situation that has become very one-sided in favor of the payer. And if I could say just a little bit more about that, when a provider signs a network contract, which is the majority of care is delivered by in-network providers who've contracted with payers, And in just about every single contract, and I've been looking at contracts, I've never seen one that didn't have it, there's a provision that says the provider agrees to comply with the utilization requirements of the payer, and that the payer can at any time amend those requirements. The provider is oftentimes given a period of time in which to object to those amendments. But the bottom line is usually if the provider doesn't accept the amendments, then their only real option is to terminate their contract, which has all sorts of consequences for the provider and also for their patients. So it's a very one-sided situation, with payers adding layers after layer after layer of prior authorization over the years, you know, to the point that the payers themselves recognize that they've gone too far and are eliminating scores of procedures that require prior authorization. And also note that payers themselves have gold card programs that with their own requirements, that if a provider meets them, they are gold carded for their work that they do. And in concept, this bill is no different. It simply puts it in place for providers across the spectrum of the healthcare environment, rather than requiring each provider to go through a costly and time-consuming process of trying to achieve a gold card status on their own. I believe this bill does restore the balance in the payer-provider relationship to a large degree. You asked the question, Mr. Chair, about 80%. I think from my perspective, if a provider is meeting the standard 80% of the time, they're likely to meet it 100% of the time. And in fact, what we are talking about here is a situation where, you know, there are very few that need to be corrected by prior authorization, but it applies to everyone. Some studies show 96% of the time there's eventually approval, which means patients are waiting, providers are spending their time, and insurers are spending their time and money to go through a process that really yields little for anyone involved. So I thank you, Mr. Chair and senators on the committee, for listening today to this bill and to the testimony on it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have with respect to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. I'm not sure if you can answer this question or not, but one of the biggest issues, in my opinion, that patients experience is claims being denied. Does this bill prevent claims from being denied? I was reading somewhere in the packet where it says that 15% of all claims submitted to private payers for reimbursement are denied. I really think it's more than that. So are you able to answer my question? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, thank you for that question. I'll try to with respect to this bill anyway. My understanding, and Senator Wilson or Ms. Fonoff could elaborate on this, my understanding is that this bill says if a provider is exempted from prior auth, that it cannot be denied later for lack of prior auth. Now, there are other provisions in the policy, such as the need for medical necessity, and as Dr. Silva said, medical necessity always needs to be demonstrated in the claims payment and in the medical record. So I guess, Senator, there could be a time where medical necessity is found after the fact not to be sufficient. But this bill, I don't believe, would impact that situation negatively in any way, and in fact, may help on the other side. So I hope that's about the best answer I can give you for your broad and cogent question, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you. That was good enough. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for Mr. Davis? I have a question. Mr. Davis, in your experience, when other states have adopted similar legislation, what is the effect on overall price of procedures and healthcare costs been? Have prices gone up? Have they gone down? Have they stayed relatively the same? What's been the effect of this legislation on
cost of healthcare?
Through the chair, I think that was you, Senator Dunbar, asking that question.
This is Chair Bjorkman. Sorry.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very hard to tell on the teams. Thank you for that question. I must confess that I do not have experience in other states, but what I can tell you is that, as I mentioned earlier, 96% of the time or so, and some studies have shown 85 to 96% of the time, when prior authorization is requested, that it is approved. So I don't believe that an exemption at the 80% level would have an impact on the cost of care or the cost of health insurance one way or another as a direct result of that. But what I would comment on is that there are other studies that have shown by some of the professional associations that physicians end up spending between 10 and 15% of their time on prior authorization. And we pause and think about that for a minute. 10 to 15% of their very valuable time spent on something that 96% of the time across a whole spectrum results in an approval. And for that provider, probably 100% of the time results in approval. If all the physicians in Alaska were able to be 10 to 15% more productive, if they were able to eliminate physicians in their practices that deal with prior authorization on a full-time basis. I know of one practice in Anchorage that employs two people, non-physicians, full-time in addition to the physician's time, just dealing with prior authorization. Could it be, and this is speculation on my part, but could it be that that increase in physician productivity and decrease in staff costs could in fact have a stabilizing or a decrease effect on the cost of healthcare in the future? I think it might. And I think that it would be fair to say that the payers probably expend as much time, energy, and money on prior authorization as the payers do. And perhaps if that were eliminated, it would result in some economies on the payer side as well. I hope I've answered your question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Dr. Silva, if you're online still, I'd like to pose the same question to you, your experience in Texas or other states that you might be familiar with. Have you seen a change, significant change in cost as a result of the institution of a similar prior authorization bill in Texas?
So, Senator, thank you for the question. And through the chair, it's an excellent question. Off the top of my head, I am not aware of a study that's documenting that one way or the other. But I can give some anecdotal perspective, just interacting with physicians and receiving feedback. And I perceive my Alaska colleagues would be similar, and that is the following is, you know, I hear story after story from my colleagues about delays in care leading to increased utilization of services for their patients. For example, one physician told a story that he was trying to get a CAT scan on a young person that had abdominal pain, and he couldn't get the prior authorization. It was delayed. It took several days. And when they finally did it, not only did they find appendicitis, but they found that the appendicitis had ruptured. The patient had an extra surgery, a complicated surgery, a complicated hospital course. So obviously the expenses put out from an economic monetary perspective were increased, but just the experience and what that caused the patient and the physician in emotional distress and really not feeling like they could practice the best care possible, you know, it's really hard to measure that. So I think in answer to your question, anecdotally, I think that a program like this where we ensure that physicians can provide timely care and the best care possible, that I think the economic benefits would be favorable, and hopefully there'll be a study that will prove that. And if I hear of one, I'd be honored to share that with this group. Thank you.
Most excellent. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Up next is Dr. John Kelly. Mr. Kelly, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and location for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dr. John Kelly. I'm a neurologist currently based out of Wasilla and transitioning back to my home in Fairbanks. I appreciate the opportunity to contribute to the discussion. So I think I'm going to tailor my comments to one disease state in particular, because this is one that's dear to my heart, and that is multiple sclerosis. Many of you know people, maybe even have family members who have multiple sclerosis. It's not terribly uncommon, and it's actually more common in northern states, especially Alaska. This is a disease that, for me personally, I've been following this throughout my career, which has been 34 years long. When I first started training as a neurologist, we had nothing to offer these patients except high-dose intravenous steroids when they had flare-ups or exacerbations. So if somebody came in with loss of ability to walk, a clumsy arm, slurred speech, we would hit them with high doses of steroids and get them through that event, and then basically say, well, call me the next time you have a flare-up and we'll do the same. And that was pretty much the management of multiple sclerosis at that time. About 25, maybe 30 years ago, the first actual disease-modifying drugs came out. And those drugs helped to a slight degree. They decreased the flare-ups by about 20 to 30%, which was better than nothing. So we treated patients with those. They were as a class called the interferons. And the interferons had some benefit, better than nothing, but they had a terrible side effect for the most part. And that was that you would feel like you had influenza for about 3 to 4 days after each injection. And these injections were given on average once weekly, depending upon the specific interferon that was being given. So imagine your doctor says, I'm going to give you this treatment. I want you to take this subcutaneous injection every Friday. And so you do that. And then Saturday morning, you wake up feeling like you've got the worst case of the flu ever. You have chills and muscle aches and run down, no energy. And this goes on for 2 or 3 days. And then by about Tuesday, you're out of bed. By Wednesday, you're feeling a little better. And then you're looking at Friday to go get your next injection. It was pretty miserable, but it was all that we had to offer at the time. Now, this is a disease where there's been tremendous advances. And if we jump forward to today, now we have treatments that are highly specific, extremely effective. Oral or even intravenous treatments are really the standard at the moment. For example, there's a drug that we can give once every 6 months, and it virtually stops the disease dead in its tracks. It's really remarkable. We're as close to not curing it, but completely getting this disease in check as we have ever been before. And I think probably within the next decade, with a few more tweaks, we'll be right there. We'll basically have this disease under complete control. So as you can imagine, those treatments tend to be more expensive than the older treatments, but the whole dictum of step therapy has required us to start the patient on older, less effective, poorly tolerated medications, and then prove that they failed it by waiting for them to have another exacerbation, another flare-up. And these flare-ups are not benign. They damage the central nervous system each and every time. Even though the patient may recover, the damage is still there. And we follow that on MRI scans and through laboratory work and so forth. So it's not like you're treating high blood pressure and you're trying different antihypertensives. This is a disease that's progressing and attacking and then withdrawing and attacking again and withdrawing relentlessly. And there's damage done each and every time. Yet we find ourselves still by most, if not many, insurance criteria required to do so-called step therapy, meaning start with something less expensive, even though it's known to be less effective, and wait for the patient to fail it before moving on to the more advanced therapies that are doing such a good job at controlling it. So this is probably the best example I can think of where this bill would actually help prevent harm to patients. We track their disease, not just clinically, but also by MRI scan, and we can follow the actual volume of white matter disease and see it progressing all along. And we know that the clinical outcome in these patients, if they continue to progress, is is relentlessly going to be poor. They lose function. Their rate of disability goes up. The rate of cognitive decline goes down. It's an aggressive disease, and it needs aggressive treatment. And this is no place for step therapy, yet we still find ourselves using that at the preference or the insistence of the insurance company. Now, I can tell you that I have a high success rate in getting the more advanced drugs approved, but it's time consuming. It takes the time of my staff and myself, sometimes a phone call to a peer, to jump through the hoops and avoid this step therapy in order to get the patient on the best possible drug from the get-go. It's a frustrating process. I've been successful in almost every case that I can think of, but it delays treatment. I have a young, very active veterinarian right now who's just recently been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. She's a long distance athlete. She does crazy things like ride her fat tire bicycle on in the snow and races, things like that. Very active person who wants to remain so, and yet here we are. More than, I think, about 5 weeks since diagnosis, still trying to get her on treatment while we jump through the hoops of the insurance company. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating for her, and she worries every day that she's going to have another flare-up and what that might mean for her in terms of her long-term quality of life. So I'll focus on that because it's so obvious how this bill could be beneficial for these patients who are, as I say, relentlessly and irreversibly harmed by ongoing attacks while we go through the hoops. It's not defensible in my mind to treat a patient that way. I'll just tell you briefly about another patient, 17 years old, came to me after her third episode of optic neuritis, which is the same disease attacks the optic nerves. And each time it does so, you're getting more and more loss of vision. So she came to me after, got in to see me after her third attack. I diagnosed her with a variant of multiple sclerosis called NMOSD, but that's irrelevant. But anyway, there's a very specific treatment for that condition. It is highly effective. Nothing else works. And yet I still faced the same frustrations with insurance companies wanting to go through step therapy. This is a 17-year-old who is progressively going blind. There's just no excuse for that. And I have to say, after one phone call to the insurance company, I got their attention and I got her on treatment that she needed. But it was a frustrating process. I tell people I would practice my speech in the shower every morning, you know, getting ready for that phone call to the insurance company on getting this young lady on treatment that was going to help preserve her vision and her spinal cord as well. So just those are a couple examples. And personally, I also have experienced this. I'm a type 2 diabetic. I changed insurance companies this year. And still, here we are, beginning of April, and I'm just now finally getting back on meds that had controlled my condition very well for years. But in the meantime, I had to go through the process of, you know, trying this and trying that, even though I was stable on a specific regimen, and my sugars went up, my A1C went up. It's frustrating. I worry more about my patients than myself, but it's a frustrating process. Anything we can do to stop harm to patients is, I think, worthwhile. So thank you for the opportunity to share my comments.
Dr. Kelly, thank you for your testimony today. Are there any questions from members of the committee? I have a question. Dr. Kelly, I heard you very clearly speak about the current authorization system leading to increased frequency of negative outcomes. Do you believe that also because of the increased frequency of negative outcomes that the current authorization system actually leads to more utilization and higher cost, because when people are eventually approved for care, they have to have more intensive treatment that costs more money?
I absolutely do. But sometimes it's not tangible to the insurance carrier because it's things like long-term disability or the longevity of their work life or their ability to remain independent in walking and activities of daily living. It's things that they don't necessarily feel that cost as much as the patient does. A patient who becomes incontinent of urine is going to cost the insurance company, I don't know, whatever the cost of depends are, and maybe seeing a urologist to verify that it's from their disease and not from something else. But I don't think they feel the sting the way that the patients do. And it's in this at this point, at this juncture in the treatment of this disease, it's every patient, in my view, has the right to the most effective, best tolerated treatment from the get-go, not jumping through hoops with therapies that are known to be less effective, waiting on proof that they don't work.
Very good. Thank you, Doctor. Up next, I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 219. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 219? Is there anyone online? Seeing and hearing none, I will close. Oh, apologies. Mr. Stranigan,
good afternoon, Mr.
joining us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Stranigan here for Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Thank you for allowing me a few moments to speak on the bill, with which we have considerable concern. We use Premier and other health carriers use prior auth to try and put downward pressure on waste, fraud, and abuse in the health system, which the American Medical Association pegs at about 25%. And it is worth noting that Premier is currently fighting a fraud. We've had claims value about $120 million as we speak, in concert with the Alaska Department of Insurance as well as the FBI. This bill, we feel, will limit the effectiveness of the prior authorization tool to apply that downward pressure. We're really concerned that the bill will be very difficult to comply with from a operational, a competitive, a program perspective. So we'll have to build a program to track all that data, assure that it's accurate, and then make decisions based on that data. And so what we might wind up with is a situation where it just doesn't make sense because this bill only applies to the fully insured market in the state of Alaska, not the state employee plan. It would, if this truly was good policy and the state was willing to pay for it. And it doesn't apply to self-funded plans. So what we might find is a situation where we just give up on prior authorizations. We don't do them. Our insurance contract stipulates we pay for medically necessary care. And so if, retrospectively, if we decide that service wasn't in the best interest of our member, and so we're not paying for it, it'll only take one or two of those times when doctors get the word out and say, we should call them beforehand. And we're right back to this crummy system with all kinds of friction, which is real. And I totally hear that. What I would suggest is that we put a laser focus on that friction and try to minimize that. And not essentially throw out the prior authorization system, which I think an 80% threshold does. So what I'm suggesting is that let's tighten the turnaround times that exist in law. Right now it's 5 days for a standard turnaround time or a standard procedure, 1 day for urgent. Let's tighten that to 3 days for standard. Leave it at one for urgent because that's still fast. On the condition that the prior auth request is submitted using an electronic portal. I think it's really important for the committee to know that right now, 55% of prior auth requests are submitted using a fax, which by definition precipitates a manual process, where and therein lies the seeds for all of this friction to grow. So streamline the process, make it work a lot better, but don't throw it out, I beg of the committee. So I've looked over my notes. I think that's in very short order what I needed to transmit to the committee, and I'll make myself available for questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Stranigan. Senator Ray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Stranigan. And so you represent Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. So my question is, what percentage of claims are denied?
That's a good question, Senator. I think it's pretty low, but I don't have that answer at my fingertips. So I'd like to forgive me through the chair, Senator Jackson. I'd like to go back to our claims department and see if I can get a number on that.
Thank you. It's Gray Jackson. Mr. Chairman, can I ask another question, please?
Indeed, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so my next question is, what percentage of claims that were denied were reversed after appeal? And I know you can't answer that right now, but I really would appreciate an answer to both of my questions if possible. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Thank you, Mr. Stranigan, for being here. Would an increase from 80% to 90% change your opinion of this bill at all?
I don't think it would. I think we'd still have the same amount of programming work to do from an IT perspective. In Texas, Mr. Chair, forgive me once again, through the chair, Senator, in Texas, they have a huge insurance marketplace. In Alaska, it's a very small insurance marketplace that we can spread that investment across, if you will. And so it, whether it's 80 or 90, as far as we're concerned, we would still have to build the same system across whether we're serving Alaskans or Texans. And it makes it so it's very difficult to pencil it out, if you will.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Further questions from members of the committee? Mr. Stranigan, thank you for being here today.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right. I have a couple of questions for Deputy Director Carpenter. Thank you for joining us today. My first question is, does the Division of Insurance see any problems, pitfalls, or have any concerns with this bill? And if so, what are they?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Deputy Director, Division of Insurance, and apologies, Director Wing Heyer is on travel status today, so I am doing my best to fill in. The division is neutral on this bill. The only thing we would give to the committee to consider is changing it from an immediate effective date to a specific effective date, because the division will need time to write regulations.
Very good. Thank you. So you don't see, if this bill were to take into account state insurance plans, would that change your opinion of the bill, do you think?
Chair Bjorkman, I think if it were to go beyond insured plans, you would need to speak with a Department of Law as well as those who might represent Alaska Care. Like we have had similar conversations on another bill in this committee, those plans are not overseen by the Division of Insurance, and they follow ERISA laws and lots of other things. So the insured market is truly what is regulated by the Division of Insurance, which includes the individual market, small group, and large group plans. So that's about 15% of the healthcare market in Alaska.
Very good. Thank you, ma'am. Other questions for Deputy Director Carpenter? Thank you.
I have a couple of questions for Mr. Kozin. Are you still online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Mr. Kozin, from a perspective of hospitals in Alaska, how would this legislation affect your mission and your ability to complete your mission to provide care for patients every day?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. It's a really good question. I first want to commend all the testifiers and the information they shared. I feel like the way they were able to articulate this issue was so spot on. I mean, you talk about our mission, especially in a hospital setting where we will serve anyone regardless of ability to pay. For us, this bill is really all about putting doctors and patients together and removing unnecessary barriers or hurdles when care is needed. And what I mean by that is you have a bill that's crafted to take really the best of the best of providers in terms of going through this process, only ones that have achieved this certain threshold and say, as Mr. Davis said, you know, 80% or 90%, whatever the threshold is, you are successful in putting this paperwork forward. So you no longer need to go through this paperwork. And so then the idea that you can eliminate that process, you take out that delay for the patient. I mean, how many times have we had our patients or been a patient where you said you need a certain procedure or a certain scan, and you have to wait until the provider and their team can work with your insurance company to figure out if it's even authorized, if it even meets their judgment. So to answer your question very directly, this is about removing all of these unnecessary steps, because we're talking about such select instances, and making care more available and in the hands of our doctors, our providers, and our patients. So it's very consistent with our mission. And we think this bill makes a lot of sense because it's reasonable and it, you know, keeps the process in place, but provides a reasonable avenue for how to use it going forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kozin. Any other questions for Mr. Kozin? Seeing and hearing none, is there any further committee discussion or questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, I'm setting an amendment deadline for this bill, Senate Bill 219, on Wednesday, April 10th at noon. Set this bill aside for further consideration at that time. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. back on the record here in room 105. Just a little cleanup on our last bill, Senate Bill 219. We'll close public testimony. And now we will take up House Bill 97, Self-Storage Units, Liens, Sales. Here with us today in Senate Labor and Commerce, we have the Honorable Representative Mike Prox and his staff, Eric Cordero, with us to present the bill. Gentlemen, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, I am Representative Mike Prox, House District 33.
For the record, Eric Cordero, staff to Representative Prox.
So House Bill 97 is about storage liens for self-storage units. And storage lien laws are the national standard for settling disputes between facility owners and unit renters. These laws provide protection for both the unit renters and the storage facility owners in the event that rent is not paid and contents of a storage unit are abandoned. And Alaska is the last remaining state without a self-storage lien law. And consequently, we have no consistent process for resolving these liens. And that creates confusion for both the facility owners and the tenants, and we have relatively little consumer protection for self-storage renters. In states with self-storage lien laws, there are clear statutory guidelines and procedures for handling delinquent tenants. The absence of such laws in Alaska makes it harder for customers to understand their rights and responsibilities. Self-storage facility owners in Alaska face legal challenges when dealing with delinquent tenants because it follows the warehouse lien laws, and that is a court-driven process. The absence of clear regulatory guidelines on how to handle non-payment and abandoned storage units makes it difficult to recover unpaid rent, evict delinquent tenants, or properly dispose of abandoned items. And so self-storage unit facility owners rely on rental income to cover their costs and generate income. Without a streamlined legal process, these facility owners face financial losses due to unpaid rent and delays in recovering abandoned units. This results in higher rental rates for customers when facility owners must account for potential losses when setting rental prices. HB 97 provides a process for addressing these situations in which self-storage unit renter fails to pay their rent or otherwise abandons their unit, and the facility owner needs to access the unit to sell the unit renter's property to recover the debt or simply to clean out debris from the unit to make it available for the next renter. National data from the Self-Storage Association indicates that facility owners only sell approximately 1 to 3% of spaces annually. It's an unfrequently used procedure, but it is necessary for the successful operation of the storage facility because they have to deal with the other 90%, which are just abandoned with no commercially valuable property in the storage unit. So HB 97 would require facility owners to include specific information regarding their facility owner's lien rights and the rental agreement, the lease that governs the relationship between parties. HB 97 would also require the facility owner to send a default notice to the unit renter before a lien enforcement can begin. If the unit renter does not cure the default, the facility owner would then be required to send a second notice of default to the unit renter at least 10 days after the first notice. The second notice must provide an additional 20 days window for the unit renter to cure the default and pay the debt owed. After all this, if the debt is not paid, then HB 97 would permit the facility owner to proceed with a sale for the abandoned items and recover the rental unit. HB 97 details that process and how proceeds from that sale must be applied in a fair and equitable manner. So That's the long and the short of HB 97. And now my staff, Eric Cordero, will go over the highlights of the sectional analysis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Representative Prax, welcome to Labor and Commerce. Thank you. I heard you say 1 to 3% of the storage units are sold.
No, I didn't state that correctly. 1 to 3% of the lien enforcements involve commercially valuable property stored inside. The other 90% of the lien enforcement just enables the facility owner to access the unit basically to clean it out. And they find either an empty, ideally an empty facility so they don't have to do any cleaning work, but otherwise they'll find packing material and basically junk left over with no commercial value.
Okay, so one more time, Mr. Chairman, for me to read. So 3% of the stuff that they deal with on a non-payment is able to be sold, has some value, and the other 90% is going to the dumpster.
Pretty much.
That's okay.
Yep.
We got it.
Other questions for the bill sponsor? Mr. Cordero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The new law is basically highlighted on Section 3, so I'm going to go briefly over the other ones. Section 1 and Section 2 basically exempt the new law from abandoned vehicles and the carrier warehouse and livestock liens that currently exist in statute. Section 3 is what creates the self-storage facility liens law, and basically it allows the facility owner to have a contract that specifies what their rights are and what they have to do and the process. So the section details that a facility owner has a storage lien on a unit property if the unit renter fails to abide by a written rental agreement, including paying the rental charges and reasonable late fees. The subsections that follow pretty much are the details on how this works. Subsection 600 details the facility owner has a storage lien on unit property if the unit a rental agreement, including paying the rental charges. Subsection CO5 is the priority of the storage liens. Basically, the storage lien is superior to other liens and encumbrances. A storage lien is superior to a security interest protected under AS 4529, which is recreation or marine vehicles. Subsection 610, a storage lien attaches on the date property is placed on the storage. So that has to be very clear in the contract when somebody rents the storage unit. That's when the lien attaches to the items on the storage unit. The statement that has to be in the contract notifies the unit renter of the existence of the storage lien and the method by which the facility owner may enforce the lien. Subsection 615 is the actual enforcement. It gives the facility owner the right to enforce a storage lien after a unit renter has been continuously in default for at least 10 days. Subsection 620, it gives the owner the right to deny access and to remove the unit property. The section also allows for the facility owner to tow or otherwise remove a vehicle or watercraft from the storage facility. Subsection 625 talks about the notice that has to be given. It requires the owner to notify the unit renter and any lien holder identifying the rental agreement that a unit renter is in default before enforcing the lien. Subsection 630, it gives the owner the ability to dispose of the unit property, allowing them to, if the renter doesn't cure or remedy the debt, then it gives them that opportunity. 635, sale and disposal of unit property. It allows the facility owner to sell unit property at the storage facility or nearest suitable location or online. Many states actually are doing it online because it allows them to have a bigger pool of potential bids, and it's also easier on people instead of having to go through to the facility in person. 640, redemption by unit renter, vehicle owner, or vehicle lien holder. Before the sale of the property, the unit renter may redeem the unit property by paying the amount due, in which case the facility owner shall immediately return the property to the owner, to the renter, sorry. The vehicle owner of record or a lien holder pays the amount due before the facility owner disposes of the vehicle. The facility owner shall transfer possession of the vehicle to the vehicle owner or lien holder who pays the amount due. Subsection C of 640, facility owners is no longer liable for property after it was returned under A or B of this section. Subsection 645, good faith purchases. This pretty much protects anybody that purchases items from the storage unit from any liability. Subsection 650, vehicle title, stipulates that if a vehicle is sold at a public sale and is titled, the Department of Administration shall transfer the title to the purchaser. And proceeds of sale, 655, the section details how the facility owner is to apply the proceeds from the disposal of private property to satisfy the storage lien. Subsection 660, limit on the value of property stored. Generally, when the contract is made, the renter has to disclose the value of what's inside the storage unit. So this limits how much an owner of the storage unit can ask for in regards to the property. There's a limit on the actual value. 665, additional rights and obligations, specifies that a rental agreement may contain other rights, duties, and obligations not required in the provisions of House Bill 97. Then subsection 670, it adds terms and definitions. Section 4 of the actual bill clarifies that Unclaimed Property Act of Alaska statutes do not apply to the self-storage facilities. Section 5 amends the codified law, stating that this act only applies to rental agreements entered after the effective on or after the effective date. So that is the sectional, Mr. Chairman, and we do have a very brief PowerPoint. I don't know if you would like me to go through that or answer any questions.
Senator Bishop has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for the bill sponsor. Section 34, 35, 655 talks about the disposal of proceeds. Is this going to be further defined in regulation? And this is where I'm going. So it spells out clear how these proceeds are to be cared for, and then they're to be remitted to the Department of Revenue if nobody steps up to claim them. So are these going to be held in an escrow account under this person's name? Are they going to be in an interest-bearing account, checking account, cash box at the lien? You know what I'm trying to say. Can you help me with this?
At this point, that would be left up to the facility owner. Good point. The way the bill is written now, the facility owner is entitled to past due rent and expenses dealing with cleaning up the unit and selling the property. And then if there is extra money, then they have to keep it for 3 years and then give it back to the renter if they show up, or to the lien holder in the case of a vehicle. But the facility owner is not making a profit, if you will, on the sale. If you have a painting or something that is worth a considerable value, for the sake of discussion, we'll say $10,000. There's no lien on that painting. So it goes up to auction. Maybe it auctions for $2,500. the facility owner just keeps the what's due him for the past due rent and the cost of selling the painting, and then holds on to the rest of the money, and the renter shows up and can claim the difference. If the renter never shows up, then it goes to the state into unclaimed property. And so then the question comes up, well, what's the protection for the unit owner? Well, the bill requires notification before they can start the sale process. It takes about a month to get through that.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, we're almost out of time today, I think. And so we might not be able to... I don't know if we're going to have time to go through the presentation or not. So I just wanted to get some questions to you for the next hearing. You know, so I'm sure you've seen the letter from Global Credit Union.
Yes.
That came out with a variety of sort of concerns. Do you have sort of answers to their concerns about or proposed amendments to any of them? You know, things like the priority of the lien, some of the title issues, the proceeds of sale, I think some of it goes to Senator Bishop's point. The one issue I had, the priority of lien, I think, is sort of interesting. Mm-hmm. And we're thinking of, you know, banks versus these facility owners. Maybe that seems like kind of a fair fight. But I was thinking about, you know, what if you had a child custody case that or a child support payment, for example, that resulted in a lien because of unpaid child support, those kind of things. Usually child support is the first priority of any kind of payment. But I'm just curious, you know, would this trump that? You know, and you don't have to answer that now, right. But I think those are the kind of questions I'm curious about when we're talking about priority. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for bringing that up. I hadn't thought about it. You can't get ahead of the IRS. I don't know if you can get ahead of child support.
Well, I don't think you'd want to.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Further questions for the bill sponsor? Well, thank you. We are out of time, so I think we'll take up the presentation at a future hearing. We do have one member of the public who came and sat here all day in order to testify, and we will invite him up to provide some testimony, and after that we will close out our meeting today. So at this point in time, I'll open public testimony on House Bill 97.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Jenkins. I own Space Unlimited here in Juneau, have owned it for just over 40 years, and I'm an operator. My suggestion is I have several specific concerns about the bill. There's a lot of misinformation going on about the need for a bill, but I'm not arguing against the need for a bill. And I'm not here arguing pro or con any organization. I've just been in the business. I've seen what happens day in and day out, year by year. And there are a lot of assumptions in the bill that are not correct. There are a lot of provisions in the bill that are extremely egregious from a public perspective, fairness perspective. We do have a lien law in Alaska, which is referred to like it was not effective. But we've been operating under that lien law for 50 years in Alaska, and it's very short, but it is very effective. And this law actually takes all the provisions of the lien provisions that are in the warehouseman law and just puts it in this bill and embellishes them. So it's not that we don't have lien law provisions in Alaska, we do. But I'd like your committee time is up, and I would rather speak to it in a little more depth if I could as to some of the provisions that would be extremely unfair to your constituents, who would be the renters, and then perhaps yourselves, if any of you happen to rent space. And so with that would be my comments at this point. I would like to speak to the committee in a little more detail at some point down the road.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Jenkins. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure how the chair wants to handle that idea of you coming back with more detail, but are you able to maybe put some of your comments in writing and email it to us?
Is that good? Right.
I think that would be very helpful.
It's just the difficulty is, if, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, if you don't understand the details of how the business works, sometimes it's a little difficult to explain it in an email without being extremely long. And but if that's the preference of the committee, I can do that.
I don't want to speak on behalf of the chair, but I think written comments are usually helpful.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar and Mr. Jenkins. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Mr. Jenkins, have you spoken with other people in this industry, and do they have similar conclusions that you do?
Well, I talked to, through the chair, Senator Merrick, I talked to the gentleman or one of his staff members who's supposed to be the largest self-storage operator in Anchorage. And their answer was, we're going to operate the way we've always operated. We'd just soon not get into a hassle over the language of this bill, was their provisions or their position. And that is true. I will operate exactly the same way I've always operated, because this bill is so skewed toward the owner's side of the operation that I can do what I consider as fair and reasonable as far as my customers are concerned, and not follow the what I consider are very bad public policy provisions that are in the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. Jenkins, if you could just highlight some of the provisions of the bill that you find problematic and give us a brief explanation as to why and what might be different, I think those suggestions would be very welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Very good.
I can do that.
Thank you. Okay. At this point in time, we will hold public testimony open, and we will set this bill aside and keep it in safe storage, where it will remain unlost until a future hearing. The Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday, April 10th. We will hear two bills, maybe more. First up will be Senate Bill 152, Community Energy Facilities Net Metering, followed by 257, Electric Utility Regulation. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today, we are adjourned at 3:02 p.m.